Welcome to Keep the Hotel Empty. Today we've kept the hotel empty for one of my favorite vocalists. We'll just get self-disclosure out there. And a woman with quite an extraordinary story. The one and only Skye. Skye, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's good to be back home.
Well,
for sure. It's kind of funny being called a vocalist because I've just been on pause for music for so long because, like, so much other stuff has taken over. But, like, yeah, I am a vocalist. I have to, like, it's good to be reminded of that, especially when I come home, for sure.
Well, there's no way I can forget it. So it's easy for me. I, if you need a reminder, I'm here.
Yeah, I do need the reminder sometimes because it's been crazy. Like, health stuff is no joke, for sure. But we're here, we're fighting,
right.
We're alive. And music is not going away. I mean, we've been in the studio cooking. It's just been really slow cooking.
Well, I know that a bunch of other things have taken over, and I know you got a lot of irons in the fire, as always. But let's kind of press rewind a little bit, because that's our thing. And kind of start me at the start where you first think to yourself, hey, I want to sing. Because this wasn't something that was pitched to you. This was kind of your idea, yeah?
Yeah, I'm thinking back because I think I was like 7 years old. And like the funny thing is that as somebody who's like spent their whole life being a vocalist, growing up as a kid, my parents will tell you that like I was the most like obnoxious voice to listen to. Like they prayed that I'd stop singing because I was sounded so bad. And then one day I just came to my mom and I was like, I want to do a song like Hannah Montana if we were a movie at the little Girl Scout talent show. And she was like, okay, I'm gonna support her and, you know, be a good mom, but like I really hope that this doesn't become like a trauma experience for her because like this is not her thing, right? And then I get up and I'm doing it and my dad's playing guitar, it is a cool thing, and I do it for my mom the first time and she was like, wait a minute, you could sing the whole time? Like you could sound good and like pleasant to listen to the whole time? Where has that been? And I did it, and ever since then, like I was just, music was my thing.
Had you been singing to yourself prior to that?
Yeah, I mean, I just like to sing. I like to make noise. It's almost, I mean, I do have autism, so it's a verbal stim too. Like, it's just a stimming thing for me as well. Just constantly singing and making noise.
Well, and it's fun.
It is fun, for sure. But yeah, I started, and then when I got older, I just, like, my mom, I had this weird idea, like, as a kid, I loved horses, I was a horse girl, like, I was that stereotypical horse girl, and I was like, I want to work with horses, I want to be a horse vet, and I was really set on it, I was, like, for, like, 12, 13 years old, I was very stubborn about it, too, for that age, and she was like, okay, well, like, I want to ask you something, if you were to, like, live your whole life and then not pursue being a vet, would you feel regret? And I would say, I don't know, maybe I said, how would you feel about that if it was music? And I said, let me think about that. And then I came back and I said, I would regret it for the rest of my life. And then I decided I wanted to do music right then and there. Because she posed it to me. She's like, would you regret not pursuing music? And I thought about it. Because, like, I was really passionate about it. And I loved doing it. And people noticed that. But then I'd always tell them I wanted to be a horse vet.
What had you been doing with music at that point?
I think at that point, I was 12. So I had been with the Sarasota Youth Opera at that point for a few years. I started when I was 9. And my mom put me in the program because she knew I had, like, an affinity for music. And she heard it was a really great program. They are a great program. They've been on the podcast.
Yeah,
so
yeah, yeah.
Shout out to them. All good things to say about Sarasota Youth Opera program. And then I was doing that, but I was still, like, I thought it was just, like, a passion. And then one day she posed that question, and I was, like, 12 or 13 years old. And then I was, like, wait a minute. I would regret not doing this for the rest of my life. And I pivoted from there, and I, like, went full ham. And, like, all the stuff I was doing, more just, like, because I enjoyed doing music. Now it became, like, part of, like, that's what I want to do. That's the career.
Right.
So went full force on that. And then, like, in high school, you know, that's when we met. We got connected when I started jumping into not taking off from the opera stage and going into the rock scene and, like, writing my own music and doing all that stuff. And that's how we met, which was, I still think about back to that time because I thought you were, like, a scam. Like, I straight up thought you were, like, just some random, like, scam because you messaged me. Like, I heard your song and I was like, we are, like, the most unknown, unfollowed band in all of Sarasota. How have you heard our music? Like, this has got to be a scam. But we talked, and I grilled you on the phone.
Yeah, well, it was really, you know, I took that part of what I don't talk about much on this podcast, but I took that part of my LA life here with me, and I was looking for bands to work with in the studio that I could work with.
Yeah.
And I remember the first time I heard an Alone Together track, I was like, oh my God, I have to work with this group. And I had no idea how young you guys were.
Yeah, we were babies.
Yeah, so paint me a little bit of that picture when you start writing with Matt.
So Matt's my best friend. We still live together, actually. We've got a little cabin in the woods with our partners and stuff. We've like, it's, we look back and we're like, I wonder what our younger selves today would look seeing us where we are now with like our, you know, we have our own little like family in the woods with our partners and stuff. It's really nice. And we started writing in high school. We met and we both like connected on the love of music. We met in the homeschool community and we were both like really, really not well, like we struggled to fit in that community because we were very like, you know, we were the emo kids and like we really connected on that, and our music became like a big bridge for us also socially, and like we found a lot of camaraderie there. And so yeah, that's how we just started writing. I was a lyricist at first. I didn't really start like diving into composing more until I got to college, because like I really struggled. I think my learning disabilities got in the way a lot with learning the actual like systems of music theory and stuff. And it wasn't until I got to Berkeley where the way they explained it, it just clicked in my head, and I was like, oh, and now I could start actually like really composing. But together, he would take my lyrics, he would compose, and so we were a really great duo. And that's all the stuff that we did under that old whole high school band, Alone Together. It's such an old and emo name too. Like we're gonna be alone together forever, and we like literally live in a cabin in the woods with like two loving in a very loving relationships with our own partners. Like we're very clearly not alone together.
Kind of though, to some degree,
a little bit. But we still write and we're still working on stuff. We want to actually relaunch a lot of the old Alone Together tunes and put it in a new project. It's just been held up on whether or not I'm like, because I've just been in and out of the hospital constantly. So, but we're doing little things here and there. But so the writing and that relationship of like writing is still, that's a 10-year-long strong relationship.
Right.
Which is awesome.
Yeah, that's nothing to sneeze at. Anybody that has a creative partnership of any kind knows how rare
those are and that they last that long.
So before you went to Berkeley and you were just starting to write stuff, what was your inspiration like? Were you one of those people that you can sit down and write lyrics and they just start coming out? You've always had free form. Do you hear the melodies in your head before you sing them?
Okay, I'm not somebody who can just sit down and write. I can now, like it's a tool that I've learned and built and like I've over many years. But as an artist, like I'm very beholden to the whims of my own muse. Like I cannot write if that muse is not in the room with me, you know? And it's usually very much predicated on experience. And actually one of the biggest issues I've had since being sick is I've really struggled to write. Like I've been very creatively blocked, super, super blocked up. I think it's because like my brain doesn't want to look at what's hiding behind all that. And like, all I can do is like draw these really, really like, I draw a lot of pictures and I'm trying to write about it and bits and pieces. But once the muse isn't there, like it's just gone at the moment. But as a writer, like I feel like I almost get possessed a little bit. It's just, right. I all of a sudden, like the idea just exists. And then I'm just like a vessel for it to be written down. That's kind of how it feels. I know it's me actively doing it, but it feels very out of my control a lot of creatively. So I get a sense of inspiration, and then the words, it's usually words that come before music. And then the music, the words will inform the composition later on. And that's how I kind of learned to write and compose, was very much like taking what is being like the story that's being told in the lyrics and using the medium of sound to further explain that story. So as a writer, I kind of like, I'm very emphasis on the story.
Did the youth opera and the performing arts in the beginning give you that foundation, or was that always your attraction and that was just the place you found initially?
That's my vehicle, you know, like that's how my creative juices flow. And I think growing up in the theater world where the narrative is the forefront,
right,
totally, right, like made a big part of that. Like I think I learned how to understand the world as a theater performer, like through the perspective of like a character, almost like, so a fictional character being on, like as a kid, like growing up, especially being neurodivergent and like autistic, you don't understand, like the world doesn't innately make sense to you. And so like I understood the world because like I would like see social situations play out in a plot in a story, right? And I could analyze that and understand it. And that's like, even today, like my brain understands things in like narratives and stuff. Like I still like understand bad things that happen to me through the analysis and like allegories of fairy tales, because I was like obsessed with fairy tales as a kid, stuff like that. Definitely think it informed a lot of my writing style for sure.
So that's the part that you had innately, and then it got compounded with your experience.
Yeah.
Then you get to the point where you're clearly starting to show some uniqueness, not only in your talents, but your insights. This gets you to the point where you get the opportunity to go to Berkeley.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about what that was like, because I know that was a dream and a stretch, and it was everything balled in one until it was reality. And that was a big thing. So tell me a little bit about that.
I think I look back very fondly at my time at Berkeley. The only regret I have was I wish I didn't push myself so hard, because now I'm so sick, you know? My health issues started in college.
Just getting there.
Getting there was hard. It took a lot of work. I mean, but it was all the stuff we did, all the stuff I did with Alone Together, all the stuff I did with Sarasota Youth Opera. It set me up to be like, hey, like, this is – Berkeley wants somebody who's, like, when they're picking candidates, they want candidates that are going to go off and then be successful and make more money for school. So going there, what I was like, I put together a whole, like, I literally looked at it from the perspective of, I want to prove to you that, like, I take this very seriously, and I want to give you – show you that, like – empirically, this is why I think I have a good percentage chance of doing well in the industry, right? All these reasons. They all led up and put to that. And getting to Berkeley worked hard. I think, though, that Berkeley was a different beast in of itself. And it, I loved my time there, though. It was a great time. And I learned so, so much. I just think it was the first time I realized, like, talent doesn't really matter as much as you think it does.
Right.
That was the story I learned.
When was the first time that started to creep in?
It was, I mean, when you go to a place like Berkeley, you are going to, like, especially as somebody like me who comes from a really, really, like, poor economic background, then you go into an environment where you're not only competing against talent, you're competing against people who have way more resources than you do. That was the hardest lesson I had to learn. It didn't matter how much talent and how much willpower I had. There's going to be times where, like, the person who has the most money and the resources is going to get the gig. The person who gets has that. And they're always going to have a leg up on you. And you're always going to be, like, the difference between, you know, I worked 40 hours a week during school. And I had an overloaded schedule so I could graduate a year early because I couldn't afford to stay a full 4 years. I could only finish my degree if I did it in 3.
Right.
So I worked really hard. I had to go to community college during high school. I graduated high school with 60 college credits. That knocked off a semester, so that helped. And then I did summer semesters all the way through. So I did a full 4 years, but I did it in the summers as well to speed up, because I just – it wouldn't – after, like, my – eventually, like, in my last year – actually, my second year, my funding ran out, and I got really lucky because Berkeley stepped in and gave me a full-ride tuition scholarship to finish my degree. That
wow.
was a big deal. And I worked really hard for that because they pulled it was a program that they were piloting, and they picked the students that they felt like had the greatest chance of success out of school. So they funded the rest of my, I got my last year paid for by Berkeley, which was really awesome. But I wouldn't have been able to stay if I didn't, because there was no world where I could afford it. I was barely able to afford it as is.
Yeah.
Like, and working, when you're working 40 hours a week on top of all of your school, all of that, like, you're not able to go network with all the people.
No.
That's the biggest part. Like, that, the biggest thing, my biggest regret was I didn't have enough time to walk out with more of a community around me to go into the music industry with, because I feel like that was the most valuable part of going to Berkeley, was, like, those people are going to be the people that you're going to work with when you get down the line later in the industry, right? So knowing
right.
them and working with them now, like, the all of that was super valuable, but I don't feel like I got an opportunity fully to, like, fully go after that, because I was constantly working. I was constantly sick because of it. I'm still in and out of the hospital at that time because I was, like, pushing myself beyond the point of no return every single semester. So it was hard.
I was going to say, I went to school, did literally the exact same thing, took all double loads, went through summer, did all that stuff, and I worked full-time too, but only for 2 weeks. And I was like, I will not be able to do this, so I can relate in the two-week fashion of
I did it for that, like, 3 years.
That's insanity.
Yeah, now I'm like, no wonder I'm so sick. Like, they told my first semester, they were like, don't burn out. And, like, I don't even think I could have known what that meant, because I also have, like, a lot of underlying conditions I didn't know I had, and that's, like, a whole – but a big part of it, too, I think I would have been so much more successful if I actually knew what the heck was going on with my body and I didn't have to, like, take 12 years to get it diagnosed and stuff.
Yeah, right. Well, that's one of those things where time is the only thing that – you know
right.
what I mean?
Time, and so it sucks, but Yeah, going to Berklee, though, was it taught me a lot about the way the music industry worked. And it really showed me that, like, what I needed to prioritize was not only being, like, excellent and being, obviously, like, I had to be excellent. Talented, I felt like I was, that's a gift I was given, right? I got that covered. I needed to be excellent, but I also had to be, like, incredibly compelling. And I had to give people a reason to give a shit about me. And I understood that from, like, that's what I think what Berklee taught me was, like, I needed an angle into this industry that is going to not only, because my talent and my hard work and my art will not get me there alone. I have to have a story that is compelling enough that a lot of people want to hear it.
Do you think that growing up in a bigger family helped you realize that it's not just that easy to stand out?
Maybe. I don't know. But, like, in my family, I don't feel like it's hard to stand out. But I don't know. Maybe that's just me. Because, like, then I have, like, other siblings in my family who are like, I feel like everyone always talks over me. And I'm like, I don't even know what that's like. And they're like, because you're the one talking over me. But I'm also, like, well, I mean, I'm one of the older siblings. So, like, you always stand. When you're in the older position, you kind of stand out. It's not hard to – you're in a position of authority a little bit.
Yeah, right.
I inherit a little of authority.
There you go.
No, what taught me to stand out was being in a crowd of, like, 5,000 really talented kids. We were all talented, not going, like, all of us.
But you were standing out way before that.
Yeah, I think, but at Berklee, I mean, it's more concentrated. It's like the talent's way more concentrated.
Oh, of course,
you know?
Of course.
So learn, when you're in a room of, like, let's say, you know, like, I mean, the first audition I had at the school, I didn't expect to get into, like, the singer showcase because it's, like, your first semester. But that was the first time where I looked and I was like, oh, man, like, I'm at an audition where every single one of the people here are really talented and got into Berklee, you know? And that taught me you had to be really creative in standing out. And, like, the auditions where I stood out, it wasn't much really my talent or my performance. That it was my personality that people remembered. And I literally, my brain just, like, threw this from the matter. For about 4 years, I was auditioning with NBC for one of their talent shows. And I'm actually really glad it didn't pan out because I would have had all my health issues happen if it had panned out while that happened. So I was really grateful it didn't because I was like, I don't know if I could have dealt with that and my health issues at the same time. So it was like a little bit of a grace. But for about like a few years, and the number one reason they kept coming back to me, even though like every year, because like, you know, singing is like the most dime a dozen talent. And so usually like the reason they kept coming back to me was because they were like, your personality is contagious. You know what I mean? Like your story is really, like you, the way you tell your story and the way you say who you are is why we're interested in you. So Berklee taught me that there was another component as to why people were really inspired by me and felt I was talented. It was also because I had a way of telling stories and I had a way of doing it to make people care. And I also had to learn that skill set too. Like it was a skill that had to be learned a little bit. So I think that was the biggest thing that I learned there after being with a bunch of really talented kids was how, that's where I learned what it takes to stand out is when you're in a room with a bunch of other people that are really, really talented and you all deserve the job. So it's not about who deserves it the most. It's like, who's going to be like, like the person who gets the job is usually the person who's just the most interesting or the most memorable.
Right. Yeah, I can't remember who it was, but it was someone who got their biggest break in life because it was a woman. She wore a pink dress to the audition, mm-hmm. and she got the job, some leading role.
So, super famous Streisand story about how she walked in and was chewing gum, and she slipped it under the stool on the stage. And the people who were like auditioning her were like, what? Why is she chewing gum? That's, like, so unprofessional. She had two shoes that were, like, mismatched and stuff. And then she gave, like, the best audition, and they couldn't stop thinking about her. And then they went up, and they flipped the stool over. There was no gum. She, like, faked it, like, to be memorable.
Ah.
She's brilliant. And it was, like, I think it's in a Meisner book. That story was told. It was a long time ago that I read that. But it was really interesting where it was just, like, she knew. She's, like, if I come in here and do something weird, like, they're going to remember me, and then my talent will carry me the rest of the way.
Right.
Yeah.
So when you have those moments when you're starting to realize, okay, I'm in a talent pool that's a little bit different from where I came from, what's the part of you that helps you get through that? Do you try to draw on some sense of fearlessness that you have that you know you need to get the job done? Or is it just a matter of this makes me nervous, but I'm going to do it anyways?
Well, you have to like not really care about the outcome of what's happening to get rid of the anxiety. I have to forfeit caring about what happens at that. Like, I have to just know that I'm going to put myself forward, do my best, and if it what belongs to me will come to me. That's how I have to see it. So if it doesn't come my way, then I return it to the circumstances in which it came. I just try not to think about it too much.
Do you think that it's preparation that helps you feel good about that, or just that mental exercise of trying not to think about it?
No, it's really important. That it's like a stoic exercise almost, in the sense of like what comes to you, what belongs to you will find you. And so if it doesn't come your way, like you can choose, like you have a choice. Like you can feel sad and like you can't choose your feelings about it, but you can choose how you
react
to those feelings and what you do with your feelings, right? And I think the first time I learned this lesson, because that's the biggest fear. Everyone's like the rejection fear. That's what everybody fears at the end of the day, is the rejection fear. I learned how to overcome that, I think, first went at that opera house taught me how to overcome rejection big time. I was like super, super set on getting a lead role. And there was a genuine reason as to why I didn't get the lead role, and I later found that out. But I was heartbroken when I didn't get it. I was, like, so set. And I was, like, 12 or 13, and I cried for a day. I was devastated, and I cried for a whole day. And then I woke up the next day, and on my own, with my little, like, LG Razor phone, texted my maestro Jesse, and said, clearly I have some things I need to work on. Can I set up a coaching session to go over those with you? And he told me that was the day he knew that I was going to be a musician, was because I, in the face of rejection, I was motivated, you know. And that's the big thing. When you get rejected, like, you have a choice. You can feel broken by it, and you can feel heart, like, you can, but, like, what does it give you at the end of the day? Like, let yourself be sad, let it pass, and then move forward. All you can do is take action and, like, okay, if that didn't happen, then I have another project I'm going to focus and put my energy on. And if I have the – if I'm blessed to learn why that didn't come my way, then I'm going to intake that and be better. You just not care about the result. Because, like, if you put out something into the world and it flops, like, it's – you're going to attribute so much negative crap to that thing that could – you could – it could be great. You don't know where that's going to go, right? Like, I put out a song a couple years ago called Facade. It's, like, still my most listened to song on Spotify. Mm-hmm. And then, like, a couple months ago, like, out of nowhere, like, I just – you know, I'd always kind of seen, like, that leg of my music is almost like a – it could have been, but it didn't, and I failed in a way. It because I did well, but then I got sick and I had to abandon it, so I felt like I failed in a way. And so – the couple months ago, I had a high school out all the way in Saratoga, California, reach out to me, and they were like, hey, we really want to use your song in our, like, drum line performance this, like, year. Is that okay? Like, we want to get permission from you. And I said, absolutely. And then I actually collaborated and made, like, custom stems for them for their track. And they ended up, like, going to the semifinals with the song. And it was awesome. And I was sitting there, like, you know, I could have that whole time, like, attributed all these failures to that song. Like, oh, it didn't get on Spotify editorial playlist. It didn't go viral. It didn't do this and that.
Right.
But here's what it did do. It inspired a band teacher to spend hours rewriting it. Rearranging it. So for the band. And then all of those kids listened to it. And then they all came to my Instagram page and were so excited to tell me about it and find me as an artist, you know? And I was like, how many people get to say that about their songs? I know, like, there's artists who have millions of streams who've never, like, gotten an opportunity to, like, have their music impact kids like that, you know? And, like, the whole reason they took it was because it's talking about what it's like to walk through the world masking and wearing a facade. And, like, and they got to express themselves and tell a story that meant something to them with my music. And I'm like, that's a win. That's not a failure. Like,
100%.
Right. So you don't know where that stuff's going to end up.
Yeah, I guess that's kind of the double-edged sword of how easy it is to release music right now.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So you get to that point where you are writing, you are still, you know, doing the music thing, but then this is when your health starts to really kind of take over, yeah? Or be the...
Yeah, it was really bad.
The headpin.
So I started, after Berkeley, I moved to Los Angeles.
Natural progression.
It was, I picked Los Angeles because of just the majority of my network was there. It was between.
No winter there.
Yeah, and there's no winter there. Well, I liked the winter. I liked being in the seasons in Boston. But I picked LA because there's something in my gut that was like, I felt like I needed to be there. I still don't know the answer as to why. I'm not somebody who would say I'm like, I grew up religious, but I'm more like kind of like agnostic / spiritual in the sense where sometimes I just get a sense that like I have to do something and I just do it. And then I find out later why it was important. So I still haven't figured out why it was important to move to LA though. I hope I find that out. But I went there and I was running a business full time and I was doing really well. I had a full time employee. And I was doing, and that the goal with that was I didn't want to have to I knew that with the kind of projects I wanted to do long term, I needed to take a route where I needed to establish some sort of self-funding. I knew that if I kept trying to take a label route and try to chase funding, that I would spend a lot more of, like, why don't I just spend that time instead using some of my, like, highly marketable skills to, like, build my own wealth of resources. That was my mindset around that. That's why I did the business alongside doing. And I was doing, like, social media strategy. I got really good at that. So it also helped me. Like, my own music kind of informed a lot of the stuff I was doing with my clients that were, like, realtors and small businesses and stuff, because I would, like, learn from my own music and stuff. So it was kind of like a symbiotic relationship. It's doing really well. But I was not a good relationship, a really, like, borderline abusive, like, really bad. And I needed to get out of it. But the problem was, I was in LA living in a house with that ex of mine and then two other people. And the other person was also a person I was working with from Berkeley, a friend from Berkeley. And so that, like, summer, I do think the stress of all that played into my health declining really quickly and really rapidly, because that summer, things were just, like, I got to a point where there was so much conflict in the house, because, like, the two other people that were there, one of them I brought in, the one my ex brought in. So it was just, like, so much conflict in the house. It was, like, I put myself in the worst situation ever. Like, I look back and I'm like, oh my gosh, like, so many red flags I just did not listen to. Oh, the woes of being young. Right. So nice having a prefrontal cortex now, you know? Yeah. But it was not, I didn't want to be home. And so I was spending a lot of time just trying to, like, improve myself. I was at the gym a lot. I was trying to work on my health because I started noticing there was a lot of pain in my body. And it just got worse, and it wasn't getting better.
Was that the first thing you just started having, like, anomalous physical pain?
Yeah, physical pain in my body was the first. And I had gone on a long journey I was late diagnosed with autism ADHD, and a lot of my music was, like, a lot of my following came because I wrote music about that, like, that journey and stuff. So I'd gone on that really long journey, and then to, like, find out, like, oh, well, I'm still experiencing problems with my sleep, and my stomach still hurts, and my, like, and I'm going to the gym every day, and I'm eating really well. Something is wrong. I shouldn't be hurting, right?
Right.
So, and the other things I noticed were, like, at the gym, I noticed that, like, no matter how hard I tried, there were certain things I could not perform correctly with proper form, no matter how hard I worked at it, and it would actually feel like it would get worse and worse. So right up until then, I was starting feeling sick. I went and I did some research, and a lot of my mutual network on TikTok, because of my, like, neurodivergencies, the condition I have is highly comorbid with my neurodivergencies. And so a lot of the people in my mutual network would be describing their experience. And I'd be like, that sounds very similar. And I was like, oh, I should look into this little thing called hypermobile Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, because a lot of my mutuals were experiencing that. And I was like, okay, let me read into it. I'm reading it. And I'm like, oh, shoot. And I'm looking at it, and they're like, okay, like, I looked up the Batten test, and they're like, can you put your thumb to your forearm, stuff like that. There's all over the body, and all those joints are super, I can spend them way too far. And I went to the doctor, and I told them, and they measured it, and they were like, oh my goodness, like, yeah, let's get you in touch with a geneticist, because that's the route you take to get this diagnosis, right? The next day, I am trying to go about, I wake up in the most pain I have ever been in my life. I woke up bawling my eyes out, I was in so much pain. And the pain had just been accumulating around my ribs, that's where it was growing. And I have, like, the worst, like, I'm so bad about gaslighting myself and my own symptoms and stuff. No, it's really bad.
Worse when you really know
bad.
That.
Yeah. I'm better about it now. It got so bad that I developed, like, a trauma pathway to, like, unlearn. Like, I could only unlearn it through, like, deeply traumatizing myself. So now I have, like, PTSD and I have to behave otherwise.
That's one way to do it.
That's one. I don't recommend. Don't do it that way. Go to a therapist or something. But I was in, like, going throughout my workday. I was in a Zoom meeting and I'm like in so much pain and I'm throwing up and now I can't stop throwing up and I can't keep water down. And I'm sitting there like, I don't think this is good. But I was also in a situation where I felt really unsafe at home. And one of the things was, is that I was having issues. I was going back and forth with the doctor and the people in the house would often, like, you weaponize that against me, like, in a lot of ways. Like, it was very much like I got to a point where I felt like if I was sick, because we were trying to, you know, really negotiate and just figure out who was going to stay, my ex or me. And if I was sick, they would use that as a reason as to why I shouldn't stay on the lease because I'm not reliable, right? And I was terrified of being sick and being unstable, probably why I still went to work and kept doing stuff. And I'm literally, like, can't function. And I text my grandmother, who's a doctor, mm-hmm. and she's like, what are you doing? Go to the emergency room, like, right now. And then I text the people, and it wasn't my boss, it was my clients. I text my clients, who I also was friends with, and I told them what was going on. And they're like, why are you on the phone with us, and why are you not at the hospital? I'm still gaslighting myself. And I look over, and my cat is on the couch next to me, and he is, like, this close to my face. His ears are flat against his head. And his eyes, I've never seen them that big. And I've never seen him that scared. And he's looking at me like, something's wrong, Mom. I'm like, it's Mommy, something's wrong. And I was like, I'm calling 911. I called 911. They rushed me away in an ambulance. I get to the hospital, and they tell me, you had 1 hour left. If you had called 1 hour later, you would have died because you were in septic shock.
That's what I was going to say. This was your round of sepsis.
That was my sepsis. I had a kidney, I had a UTI that backed up to a kidney infection, but the UTI was asymptomatic. I didn't know I had it.
Right.
Backed up to my kidneys, infected my kidneys.
This was the abdominal pain.
That was all the abdominal pain that I was experiencing in my ribs, and I was hospitalized for 6 days. And I got out, came home. My mom, it was so bad. I was so alone. I was so by myself because I was all the way across the country. And the only people I had were, like, a couple friends, and then my main support system was my ex at that time, right? And I'm freaking out.
Rightfully so.
Right, I'm super alone. And it was so bad that my client flew down from Northern California to stay with me till my mom got there because she was so worried about me. Like, it was her. She was a homie. She
that's
really
amazing.
Helped me through a lot during that time.
Very cool.
Really good friend. And then my mom came. She brought me home, and it was weird. This is the first time I'm telling this story, like, for real. Like, this is, like, anywhere outside of, like, my therapist's office or, like, friends and family. My mom stayed with me for about 4 days, and then she had to leave, and she was, like, kind of helping me, taking care of me, because I wasn't really, I wasn't functional. I was still septic. I was just not in ICU anymore.
And for anybody that hasn't known anybody or anything, experienced that, even when you make it through sepsis, the aftermath is...
It was like 6 months until I felt like I could like stay awake for a full day.
Right.
Yeah. Like my hair fell out. I have a lot of hair too. And that was horrible because like my hair is like my biggest, like my whole life, nothing I've ever felt. The one thing I've not felt insecure about is my hair. And it fell out on me. Rice water fixed it though. That saved my hair, baby. It was rice water. But I was, she's taking care of me, helping me. And, tension in the house is still really, really high. And my mom's like, I don't want to leave you here by yourself. Like, she's like, do you think your ex would hurt you or something? And I said, maybe. And she was like, I don't like that you said that. You should have said, like, absolutely not.
You can't say that to a mom.
Yeah. And she was like, I don't like that you said that. And I was like, I don't know. He's like kind of unhinged. Like, who knows? But I was like so sick. And then at the time, we had been taking turns on the upstairs because we'd shared a room, right? So we took turns swapping, sleeping on the couch and sleeping in there. And my mom was going home, and like the day I dropped her off of there, she's free. She's like not wanting to leave, and she's really stressed out. And I'm starting to feel that too. I'm starting to feel nervous, and I'm starting to feel like less safe. And then she drops me off. I drop her off at the airport, and I go back to my house in LA. And that day, my ex comes up, finds me, and he says, okay, I'll be taking the bed tonight. And I was like, I've been out of the hospital for 4 days. I'm not sleeping on the couch. I have a septic kidney infection, and I have a connective tissue disorder that causes my joints to dislocate and sublux. Like, I cannot sleep on the couch.
Right.
I'm like, and the way the room was set up, like, I was like, listen, like, because I put our bed was in this big walk-in closet because it was a loft room that, like, looked over the living room. Mm-hmm. It's like, listen, like, you're going to have to get another mattress anyway because that one's mine. I'm going to be taking it. So why don't you just put it on the loft, and then like I'll sleep in I call it the hobby hole. I sleep in the hobby hole, and you'll sleep in the loft, right? We'll make it work. So then we both have a bed, and he just doesn't say anything and shuts the door in my face, right? And then I think it was either that evening or the next day, the other roommates came, and they all like gotten really aggressive with me and like came up a in-person confrontation saying like, this isn't okay. You're kicking Jacob out of the room. Oh, wait, hold on. For editing purposes, can you pull that out so I can take? I don't want any names. He They said, you know, you can't kick him out of the room. Like, you know, all your, you are just trying to take this for yourself. And I said, that's not what I said. Like, I had a compromise in place, and like I offered, and I said, that's a lie. And then like right in the middle of it, like while they're all fighting, my ex is like, well, I'm not doing that. And you like, that's absurd. Like, I'm unwilling to do that. And they're like, yeah, he's unwilling to do that. So like, and they're all fighting. And I just look and I'm like, they're going to kill me. If I stay here, I'm going to die. Like, I'm not going to make it out alive of this. Like, they're going to, like.
Well, you've got no energy at this point.
No, I have no energy. I'm very, very ill. And, like, further putting even more stress on me where my body cannot handle stress whatsoever. And
no,
I knew, like,
kidding.
I think the stress of it alone, like, I knew instantly, like, in this environment, I will not be able to heal my body because I will be constantly afraid for my life. I'll be in fight or flight still.
Yeah.
You can't heal from sepsis when you're in fight or flight. And so I was like, I gotta go. And it was like so bad that like my mom calls me on the phone and I'm like, hold on, I need to step out and take a call. And they're like, we know you're lying. Like, don't try to run away from this. And I like turned my phone around and I was like, I'm walking out of this room and you're gonna let me. That's how dangerous it was. And I just told my mom and I said, I can't stay here. And I texted Matt.
That part she already knew.
Yep, she knew. She's like, I need to go. And I said, let me call. I'm going to call Matt because I wanted to. My house is really full and there's a lot of people. And I still wanted to maintain some sense of independence. I eventually had to go back to Florida for a little while. But I wanted to. My plan was to move out to Tennessee from LA to go stay because I was like, I want to be where I have more support network. And like, that's where Matt was living.
Right.
In Nashville. And we still had, you know, a really tight friendship. I texted him. This is how tight our friendship is. I said, code red. Can me and Ember fly in tomorrow? And he said, get out of there. That was it. Then I booked a flight and I left. And I did, and then we came back a couple months later to get the rest of my stuff, and that was it. But it was really a lot. And from there, like, it just took about, I don't think I got back on my feet until May of 2023. And that's when I moved back out to Nashville and I started kind of getting established there.
So when you're first recovering from the sepsis, are you doing like intravenous antibiotics?
Yeah, I did antibiotics. I did IV treatments for like vitamins and stuff to like rebuild my immune system and stuff. But it was a lot of working with specialists because we still didn't understand why. We still don't know why I had the kidney infection. We're still figuring. I was at a rheumatologist today trying to figure out why are my kidneys not showing up to work half the time. Like,
right.
There's still a lot of answers. We still don't know why all of that happened, and we're still trying to figure that out. But for a little bit, we got stable, and we thought maybe it's good. But I've been in Nashville now for a year, and I very, very recently realized, like, I have to stop working and stop. I was working as an early childhood educator, and working in that job was really important. I needed a season of, like, not doing anything. Like, working with kids is really easy for me because I grew up rearing children, you know. So it's really simple, and it's meaningful. I can't go to a job every day where, like, I genuinely don't think I'm somebody who's built to work a job like that just to pay the bills. Like, at the very least, I have to feel like the work I'm doing is meaningful.
Why
do
you think that is?
Taking care of kids. I don't know. It's just how I am. Like, I worked at, like, the worst jobs. The jobs I hated the most were the jobs, like genuinely the jobs, like, I could not wait to quit were the jobs that I didn't care about. So I was like, okay, well, I love working with kids. It's safe. I have like 10 plus years of teaching experience. And I was like, let's take that route. And it was really good. It was a really healing time. And the school I worked with was like incredibly accommodating to me and my disorder. Me stepping down was actually like part of the reason I did it was because they're like, we literally, like, in a million years, the last thing we want is for you to not work here.
Right.
But also, like, now we're coming in as like kind of moms of our own kids. You're sick. Maybe you should stop working because, like, it's a lot on your body. Like, you can't take it. Like, stop working because, like, we want you to still be here, you know? So we're still trying to figure all that out, and it's put a big pause on everything. And so I made a big recent decision recently to just, like, stop working. I am doing more freelance stuff, and I'm trying to open out avenues to, like, get back into doing freelance because I think it's easier, a lot easier on my body, and I have that opportunity. But it's just a full-time job trying to figure out what the heck is going on with my body. Genuinely full-time job.
Right. So when you start to realize that's the case, what's it like? Do you think to yourself, do I really need to work? Did you have to hit that
point? Well, the thing is more working just because, you know, I mean, I've got a a big family. Like, my family is super, super supportive, but my family is not one of the families that can, like, shoulder a whole another adult's, like, living expenses perpetuity, right? Like, that's not how it works, right? So that's where working for me is, that's my concern. It's like, I just want to, and I also, you know, because of how unsure it's, like, the pathway, we are taking the pathway towards, like, different, like, aid I can get and support I can get from different programs and stuff that are available. It's just difficult. Like, I mean, disability stuff takes forever. And it's like, I have bills to pay for the next couple months. The reason I was able to take off those because I had some extended family that was like, and that's the thing people don't realize about being sick and disabled is that, like, you're like this one step away from being homeless. And usually the step all away the from time. It is being, having family that cares about you and is willing to help. And I have family that cares about me and they're willing to help. But it genuinely, like, I mean, we have to pool a lot of resources together to make it work. So I do want to remain financially independent if possible.
Well, yeah, of course. But really, it's always kind of been the thing with you where, I don't know any other way to put it, going to work for someone else wasn't in the cards for Sky, regardless of your health.
Yeah, no, it wasn't. I mean, I think the only job where I was comfortable working for somebody else was when I was working as a teacher. And that's just because I didn't want the responsibility of the class, the whole classroom on me. I was like, I don't have enough energy for that. Like, yeah, that's fine. But yeah, it isn't in the cards. I think I've got a lot of opportunities. I mean, like, you know, I recently had an opportunity to start working for, like, political campaigns I care about and stuff. And, like, I'm working with a candidate that, like, I actually think could do good work. It's just a matter of, like, actually getting them in office. Like, that's always the hurdle, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And realizing, like, okay, that's an avenue for me and stuff like that. It's definitely awakened a part of me that's realized, like, I have to do something about how difficult it is to survive. Why I'm not doing music, because I have to put all my energy into surviving.
That's what I just wanted to ask. So talk to me a little bit about, as far as you're willing to, what day to day is like, and what compromises that you've had to make, like not singing the way you used to or performing, or what, you know, what's day to day like, and what's some of the changes that have come with it.
I mean, the biggest change is I lost about maybe like 50% of my mobility on the whole, like just my ability to. We still don't understand why. Part of it could be that they gave me an antibiotic that I was allergic to, and they didn't, like, look at it close enough. It was a big problem. We even, like, looked into malpractice, but past the statute of limitations, unfortunately, when we started looking into it. And it could have caused an injury that made me worse. But, like, my health just, like, so rapidly deteriorated in terms of, like, the structure of my body. Like, if I were to, I could literally show you in an x-ray. I have, like, a bamboo spine. Like, I could, like, show you, because it's so crazy. Maybe we could pull that up. I'll send you the picture if you want it for the pod. Yeah, I'll just make sure I got to crop my x-ray butt cheek out of it, though.
We got a guy for that. You might know him.
Yeah, I know him. I sent it to the family group chat, and Seth's like, I could see your x-ray butt cheek. But here's it. Like, this, it looks like my neck is broken. Like, that's one of them. That's how, like, that's just me tilting my head back. I can tilt it that far.
What?
And it's, like, super flexible. And so, like, because of that, there's all of this structural instability in my body, and my body can't hold itself up. That's the main problem. Like, there's, like, no spacing in between my vertebrae and my spine, because, like, my body does not have, like, the tissue in my body does not have enough structural integrity to hold myself up. So for the most part, I experience a lot of, like, I'm immobilized a lot more than I used to be. There are days where I can't walk. There are days where I have to use a cane. Mobility aids.
Because of it's uncomfortable or because of the limitations?
Because
of the pain, yeah.
No, it's severely painful, like horrifically painful to move. I deal with, like, daily subluxations and partial dislocations all the time. I wake up every day and I have to, like, I feel like a marionette puppet that had all the tension taken out of its strings. I have to, like, restack all my bones every morning. And there are some days where I can't get out of bed. The better days, I'm able to move around and function, but my life is really beholden to constantly doing symptom management. Like, I came in the studio with 2 ice packs because I was throwing up on the one, like, a couple hours ago, because I had to start and I had to, like, try to manage to stop throwing up. You know, my whole life is just chasing symptoms. I carry puke bags with me everywhere I go. And when it was getting to the point where, like, I realized I had gotten pretty good at, like, being able to throw up without other people noticing because I was throwing up so often.
That's a
often.
Skill people
yeah.
don't.
And other people being 3, 4, and 5-year-olds who are constantly concerned about where the adult in the room is.
Right.
The way that I, like, the last time I really, like, the time that it really hit me, I was like, I need to, I can't work because if this is every day, like, I can't. I was reading them a story at lunch, and I was like, oh, I need to throw up. But I was like, I'm the only teacher in the room, so I've was not allowed to leave the room, or like that's against the law,
right?
Predicament, right then and there. And so I was some days I'd be like, okay, I gotta be right back, and I'd like walk into the bathroom in the little kid's bathroom, and I'm literally not even able to fully close the door, but I just sneak in there, vomit, and then come back out, and they didn't even notice. Like, it had just happened so quickly, and I just got so good at it. Or go in the closet with the door open still, so I'm still in the room, just puke real quick in a bag, and then throw it in the trash can, and then continue on, right? You know, and
this
I'm
is
like,
not a skill you're supposed to develop.
It's not a skill you're supposed to develop, and so I'm just constantly chasing symptom management. I do.
How quickly did you go from this all set in post sepsis, or you were starting of some of this pre-sepsis,
the pain in my body, but it was more isolated. There's still a lot of unanswered questions. It's why we're looking into an autoimmune component into this as well, because the degeneration of my tissue, and especially how quick it's happening, is like really concerning. That's the big concerning part, because it just happened so quickly. I had x-rays done that showed a little bit of degeneration and stuff, and then like even now there's even more degeneration from when they were done then. Like, it's just really rapid, and it happened right out. I think whatever happened with like sepsis and stuff uncovered some sort of autoimmune component to this, and has never let my body heal from what happened, I think that's my running theory right now. But whatever is going on with my body, it's very, very complicated, and doctors don't like complicated.
No, they sure
they're
don't.
They're actually like quite offended. I've experienced so much mistreatment from doctors that I actually have like severe PTSD now. Serious, like genuinely, like I will not go to an emergency room unless like I absolutely think I'm going to die. And usually I won't go unless someone in my support team tries to get in touch with the like patient advocate before I arrive, because I've been so mistreated by doctors. Like, I've been kicked out of a hospital and told I'm drug seeking.
Oh, fun.
Not fun when you're like really, really scared and don't know why your body hurts so bad that you don't want to be here anymore. Like, that's how bad my pain levels were. And I had an orthopedic specialist tell me that I needed to see a psychiatrist for fictitious disorder because I was making it all up. And he was like, you're wasting my time and you're wasting other medical professionals' times coming in here and asking these questions. Like, such hostility of just trying to find out what is wrong with my body, right? And it's just awful. I had a doctor, my last PCP literally abandoned me. And we're now, that's actually like a malpractice case we might actually be able to pursue. Like, because she just abandoned me because I asked in like a Facebook support network if anybody else like recommended other primary care physicians. I'm like, this clinic's really great. I just need like these extra things, you know, that's all I said. But they were in that Facebook group and I didn't know. And then they dropped me as a patient. And now I can't get care in Tennessee because my health insurance is like through Florida Blue, and I need a referral to go anywhere. So then my mom was like, screw this. We're just going to line up a couple appointments for you over the next couple weeks, and we're just going to line them all up and go see them because we can't get you care. It's so hard to get care in Tennessee out of state where I live.
It can be very hard to get care when you have something anomalous wrong with you, and you hit on something that maybe a lot of people aren't familiar with, but unfortunately I am as well. When you have something wrong with you that isn't obvious and the doctors don't want to hear it.
They don't want to hear it.
Tell me a little bit about what that was like for you.
It's like the most terrifying experience of your life to look like it's almost like, you know, you realize, like, there's like, God isn't real almost feeling, you know, of, like, you walk in and you're like, oh, these doctors don't want to help me. And that's, like, your whole life. You get to a point where you have to realize, like, oh, yeah, not everybody becomes a doctor because they want to help people. I forgot. And, like, when you're, like, it's the thing is that, like, you're coming from a place of such vulnerability to your healthcare.
Right.
There's a reason we have HIPAA laws and stuff like that for all these reasons, right?
Right.
So vulnerable. And then, like, being constantly told over and over again, like, no one wants to help you, or like people being angry at you for asking for help. That's the other one. That's the one I don't get. Like, I can deal with doctors who like feel overwhelmed by it and say like, I can't help you, but like that's the doctors.
Yeah, that's a different story.
No, it's the doctors that are like angry with you for showing up and asking for help. You're like, why? What did I do? You're getting paid whether or not you help me. Why are you being so mean to me? Yeah. Like,
yes, I've 100% experienced that. So
it's nonstop, and there's a lot of it's just like they. I don't know if it's like a post-COVID issue right now, or if this is because I didn't really experience all this stuff until after the post-COVID world. I there's definitely like shortages, because I've been trying to figure out why is this happening on like a systemic level, because I'm like, you know, trying to get into politics. So if I'm gonna get in there, I want to start studying this stuff so I can help write like put policy points like, hey. Maybe this and this will help fix the healthcare problem, right?
Right.
Because I have a voice in the room right now, so I want to be able to speak accurately and like give some advice. And one of the things, there's definitely a shortage of healthcare workers at the moment, post COVID. Bottom line, but even then, like I don't know if it's like just the way medicine always has been, and I just didn't, you know, you don't know until you discover it, until you need it. Or is
Very
that's
valuable
how it's been
point.
Here? Like, or is it this is a new era of healthcare that, like, because we dealt with so much, like, we had so many healthcare workers leave the field, and, you know, now a lot of, there's not as many coming in. That's another thing. Empirically, there's, like, way less doctors coming into the field right now. I think because a lot of them are, like, they saw what happened in COVID, and they're like, I don't want to deal with that. Like, I don't want to be in those rooms dealing with that. So, like, that could be part of it, but I don't know if it was always this way or not. I haven't been around long enough to know.
Well, I guess in some capacities, yes, but you know, it's always there's always the ebb and flow to it all. My sepsis was during COVID.
That's no fun.
But you see a lot of these doctors, it's America, you know what I mean? We have a capitalist component of it here.
Yeah.
And the whole insurance thing, and if the job is too hard to do, it becomes less profitable and you become anomalous and
right.
You become all these things. So as you're starting to let me ask you this. Has there been a point in your health journey where you've started to feel like you've made any ground?
Yeah.
And if so, who were these people and how did they behave differently?
It's the doctors that actually show up every day because they want to help people feel better. And I know, and those doctors are real. I mean, like my psychiatrist /therapist, because he does both, is so awesome. Like when all this stuff happened, he was like, you know, I want to take you on as one of my pro bono patients. I don't want you to worry about it anymore. And I want to start seeing you for therapy once a week because you're going through a lot of crap with your body and you need help. And I'm like, that's a doctor who got into this for the right reasons. It's the
right.
Doctors who care and who sit down and listen for more than 10 minutes and ask a lot of questions, like, and they are there, they exist, and those are the only times where I get answers. It's genuinely, like, my healthcare is predicated on whether or not the doctor sitting in front of me gives a shit.
What do you think is some of the ways that you can help find those people without detrimental trial and error that I've been through?
Word of mouth is helpful. Asking people in your community, like, that's why I made that post in that Facebook group, because I'm like, how else do we find doctors who specialize in what we do other than ask in groups? And so I was also very frustrated to get punished for that, because that's the only way we can find doctors without having to go there and find out. Like, doing that pre-filtering is really helpful, but other than that, there isn't a way to do that. And this primary care physician that treated me terribly and, like, was one of the worst doctors I've ever dealt with, on the whole, like, they came highly recommended.
Right.
Everybody recommended them to me. And not only did I find that they were, like, vindictive and willing to commit also HIPAA violation, because they went onto my social media and started, like, commenting, confirming I was a patient with them when I left everything anonymous and I didn't name them, and they found my social media and started harassing me in my comments. Like,
good
that's
Lord.
How bad. No, it is. This is a doctor that everybody recommended me, right?
Right.
So it's like, you're going to find them. If you have a health problem, like, you're going to have to go through this trial and error process unless something radically shifts in the way we do medicine in this country. But unless as long as there's a profit incentive, that's not happening.
Well, then that begs the question, if you had your way, what do you think the radical shifts would be?
Oh,
that would be
Sky
the
was
most
president of the world.
Well, I don't know. We can't go for world.
That's
all
my,
right, fine.
That's my
world.
Hypothetical. If I'm president of the world, how would I change healthcare?
Yeah,
right? That's,
yeah,
that's
yeah.
my favorite
We're
hypothetical.
Not even stopping at president of the United States. We're going right for president
right
of the
for
world.
The president of the world.
Okay.
Everybody deserves good healthcare.
Yeah.
Everybody in the world. healthcare needs to be a completely public resource. It can't be privatized. I mean, I think it should. The idea that there being private healthcare, sure, but there needs to be like it needs to be like not out of necessity. Like,
do you think you there's know? Any time that you've benefited from the fact that healthcare in our country is privatized?
No, I can't directly because like. I really genuinely, because the only times where I can see, like, a benefit maybe, I could see that benefit not even, like, it wouldn't even be a problem if the system didn't have private, and didn't have, like, if it was public and it was accessible. Because just from the front of, like, we know just empirically that, like, it costs less on the whole to approach healthcare and all the management of those resources from, like, a public resource level. It just costs less, and it gets across the board. Like, that's been the biggest issue for me.
But it costs less because the margins are lower.
Well, I mean, even in private healthcare, I have to wait months and months and months to see somebody that I'm paying like half of fucking house worth to see anyway.
Facts.
If there's wait times in public healthcare, there's so most certainly right now tons of wait times in private healthcare. I've never had to wait. I actually like. When I was in LA and I had public health insurance, I got much more immediate care. There were times where the care probably wasn't the best quality. I could acknowledge that. But that was when they intervened. I was on public health insurance when I had septic shock.
Mm-hmm.
And even though that hospital did give me a medication they weren't supposed to, I didn't have to pay for that entire visit. I just showed up and I went. And I would not have called an ambulance and I wouldn't have gone there if I didn't know that I could afford it.
Right.
That was a big deal to me. Like, I don't know. Like, maybe I would have gone even if I couldn't afford it. But still, that was a huge deal. The fact that I didn't, like, that was, they came in and they said, this is completely covered. And that was a big deal to me. And I did have a lot less trouble getting appointments in LA than I do here, especially in Nashville. It's terrible in Nashville. Oh my gosh. Like, I have to wait months and months and months and months and months to see anybody. But in LA, like, I mean, I was able to see my doctor and ask about Ehlers-Danlos about, like, a week after I had the thought. It was actually a lot easier to get healthcare in a place where there was more public access than areas where it's much more privatized, like LA. I mean, Nashville. Nashville's super privatized. In fact, like I've noticed that like most of the hospitals are bought up by like one company right now, and it's one company, and like they're terrible, and they're like the only. Like that or Vanderbilt really is that that's now that's really the only option.
But then you're in the university healthcare system, which is a different animal inherently.
Different animal. It's a different animal inherently. And it's like, and I was looking into it. A big part of it too is that there is a lot of things tied up in like a certificate of need. You have to like basically apply to open a new hospital in Nashville. And apparently in like Tennessee on a whole, it's very difficult to open new facilities and stuff because they have to like they're because this is where the privatization part of it too does frustrate me is that so the way they kind of approach care, and I'm not an expert on this. I'm just somebody who's frustrated, right? And
yeah,
so
you're obviously just you're experiencing it.
But like in let's say you've got a doctor's office, right, that wants an MRI machine because they're like, I don't want my patients waiting 2 weeks to go to the one or two places only available in the city. Right. I'd like to get an MRI machine. We can afford it, right? Well, they also have to go apply for like, and I don't know if this is hypothetical. I could be incorrect. Don't take my word for it. But they have to go to apply. To show that there's a need for it. And the other two places that have the MRI machine get to be a part of that decision, and they're going to say why they think that
there's
it's
no
going
need.
To impact their profit and impact their ability to serve people because it is more cost effective for everybody involved if everyone's only going to two MRIs in the city.
Right.
And these are all, but like, it's not really that cost effective. It's cost effective for them.
Well, it's the guise of fair market.
Because they don't want to lose they want to be constantly booked out, right? And so then.
Well, it's gaming the system.
It's gaming the system. It is gaming the system. And so in that instance, I'm like, if something like healthcare is like, it's something we desperately need so badly. And I don't trust anybody who has a profit incentive to give me that health care in a good way because, like, they're only incentive, like, it's so vulnerable. Like, they're always going to find ways to cut corners. And when it comes to health care, when you cut corners and when you try to slash things, make more profit, it's people die.
Right.
People don't get health care. People don't live. And it's not like, you know, there's other industries where you can see that kind of like really crappy, like, a capitalist mindset. And, like, yeah, it sucks. But, like, when we're talking about health care, like, it is life or death. And we shouldn't be going, like, I don't trust anybody whose main concern at the end of the day is to make a buck, to actually care about my health and to care about what to do. Because in that instance, like with, let's say, the MRI machines, if the person making the decision actually came from the perspective of, like, patients need care, that office would be given an authorization to have an MRI machine. And but, like, right now what we experience is that a lot of these people want to open up more and they want to create more resources, and all of these other places have a monopoly and they say no because you're going to harm our profits. And at the end of the day, like, in a capitalist mindset, the only thing that matters is profit. That's it. Does not, nothing else matters.
That matters above the preservation of the
above
free market.
Above the preservation of the free market. It's yeah. Matters of, like, it matters more, like, so much more than, like, that making profit tomorrow. Like, the making profit today, like, matters more than making profit tomorrow. So much so, like, if you kill the free market, where's all the money going to come from? Right? Like, where are we going to, if we can't afford to, like, buy medicine anymore, we're not going to buy it. And then, like, where does that go? You know, like, they're willing, it's inflating itself to a point where it'll just explode itself. And I'm like, I don't trust that to take care of me and my health.
I was going to say, if you want to live here for any period of time, you're going to have to be part of that system. That's kind of, let me ask you that. And you brought this up a little bit before. How different do you find it, your viewpoint of these things versus other people your age, because you've had experience with it that most people your age don't and won't have for decades to come. So yeah. you have an insight on this that most people your age don't, and yeah. you're going to have to vote on this and decide how it's going to be for when it's your turn to really be relying on these people.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. People my age listen more. So that's the biggest difference. People my age want. I mean, I think my generation is just on the whole a little bit more, like, cognizant of the fact that the world is falling apart and it's burning. So we're a little bit more willing to listen when someone says, here's why, here's a problem, right?
But it's hard to wrap your head around.
They can't wrap their head around it. That's
what healthcare is like until you're sitting there and a doctor's right. making you feel nuts.
They're more like, they get terrified because then they realize, oh, if I end up sick like you, I don't have medicine. That's the other, like, the difference is if you haven't experienced it and you don't know what it's like, when someone, like, makes you face that, it's quite terrifying.
It gets real quick.
Yeah, it gets real scary real quick. And then people are like, what do you mean, like, you can't, do XYZ or this is, like, yeah, that's how it is. Like, that is real life. Like, people don't, it's a bit of, the cognitive dissonance is really loud, but it's almost like because they're realizing that I'm shattering a fairy tale in their head, like, right then and there. I'm like, they also realize, like, how easy it is to become, how vulnerable you become once you're disabled. Like, I think all civil rights and all like, societal justice movements cannot move forward without a foundation in disability rights. Because I feel like ableism is, like, the biggest and, like, the most deeply rooted ism that we deal with. Because, like, you can be the most woke person ever, and I guarantee you've got some ableist crap down there that you're gonna pull out and you'll find. Like, I'm ableist to myself. Like, I sit there and I'm like, everybody deserves the ability not to work, but I don't. I actually should, like, be a workhorse for the rest of my life. Like, that's what I deserve. Like,
right.
Like, we struggle with it. Like, we don't give ourselves the time to rest. We tire our mindset to our productivity. Like, the idea of, like, people not working is, like, a moral failing, but it's like, why?
Yeah, right.
What's wrong with not working?
Right. Like, that's why I asked you before, did you ever confront the question to yourself, do I need to work? Not necessarily from a monetary standpoint, but is this a part of substantiating your existence? Do you really feel that it is?
I think as humans, we want to have purpose and we want to do things. We want to make something with our lives. That's what it is. It's not that we don't want to work for our whole lives. We want to make something out of our lives and we want to do something meaningful to us, right?
Right.
So I think I do want to do something meaningful. And the only reason why I want money is so I can, like, pay my bills and
to,
like,
do something meaningful.
Yeah, to do something meaningful. Like, I literally, like, just want enough money to, like, survive. Like, I don't even want to be rich. And that's another thing, like, that I think that helps with, like, being an artist, like, not wanting to be rich, because then I am not so devastated when I'm not rich. Like, so.
Do you think that any of your experience with your health has, and I know this is maybe too obvious of a question, but your experience with your health has helped you reevaluate what is valuable to you and how?
Yeah, it radicalized me. Really, it made me realize what was valuable in a lot of different areas, and it really radicalized me politically, for sure, because it put me in a position where I realized, like, at the end of the day, like, there's a lot of things that are really, 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 really broken. And, like, things are, like, really scary. It opened my eyes. Because, you know, when you grow up, like, I was really blessed to not have to be put in a position to reckon with that until I became disabled, you know? Because there's, like, there's so many people who go through their life, like, minorities and other minority groups who have to, like, come out the womb and then they get to reckon with that, you know? So I am glad I didn't – I'm grateful that I reckon with it in the way that I did, as much as it sucks. But
– right.
But in it also did show me and help me reevaluate because, I mean, I'm still struggling with it. I don't think I've figured it out. I don't know if I'll ever figure it out. It's going to be a lifelong battle of me trying to, like, have a better relationship with the idea of being disabled. Like, my therapist tells me all the time. He's like, you just, like, can't reckon. Like, you just can't accept that you're disabled. And I'm like, I know, because it's so different than what I used to be. Like, and it feels, it's so limiting and stuff. And so when you're given limitations, obviously you learn how to reevaluate and how to revalue a lot of things in life. But I haven't figured it out fully yet because I'm still quite upset about it. Oh. I'm still quite bent about it.
Yeah, well, that's fair. I think that had I not been born with my disability, I probably would be in that boat too. We had a guest who spoke about his father going blind, you know, later in life, and I can't imagine what that's like.
The adjustment is so brutal. It's so brutal. And it's scary, especially, I mean, you go from, like, I went from, like, lifting weights every day. I was, like, I did, full, like, a ton of physical activity and doing all that to, like, barely some days being able to move my body. I have to walk with a cane. I have to sometimes wear a neck brace for multiple days on end, you know? Like, it's...
But we can get, like, a cane with a sword in it
or something
fresh.
I have one of those. Fresh. Oh, I do. I have one of those. I got one for my birthday. Yes.
Oh, my God.
I know. See, the homies are such allies. They're such allies.
See, I'm already there. I'm right
disability
there.
Disability allies. The Matt got me that for my birthday, for my 25th. He was like, and he was so great. He handed it to me, and he kneeled down. He was like, you're being knighted today, and I got my cane sword.
It's
so lit. Yeah, we make the most of it. We make the most of it, and we try to find, like, that's part of it, is also learning to find joy in the things that usually remind you that things are shitty. Like, so having a mobility aid can, you can kind of alchemize that into something more fun. Now I have a cane.
Hell yes.
Yeah, so I'm trying to, that's a big part of it. Alchemizing as much as I can into something positive and doing what I can. But for the most part, it's still kind of day by day. It's still figuring and taking everything one step at a time until we find some answers, because it's really, really complicated. And now we're at a point where, like, thankfully I have the ability to step back and pursue this and figure this out. And that's all that's on my mind right now. At this point, too, is, like, there are so many other people whose stories are just like mine.
Right.
And they're where I am now. And they don't have anybody to help them. They're all by themselves. And that's the thing that makes me feel like I need to, like, figure this crap out, because I want to fix it for them.
Amen to
that. I don't, if I, like, if there's one thing that I'm going to, like, settle on is, like, okay, well, if I'm here for anything, it's at the very least, like, I'm going to use all this, like, ridiculous amount of willpower and drive to at least make things a little bit better, because there are people out there who are suffering like I am, and they don't have the energy to do it. They don't have the resources, and they don't have the support. So, like, I feel a little bit of a burden almost to do it, in a sense. Like, I feel like I have the ability, so I should. And I'd be doing something wrong if I didn't. Like, I don't know. Maybe that's just a little philosophy thing for me.
But I was going to say, but you generally feel that way about things in general.
Yeah, I do. I do feel about that way about things in general.
Yeah. Now you just got a big one that's just too obvious. You can't run from that
one. I can't run from it. I'm like, okay, well, like, I got to fight. Like, I mean, and I had this opportunity to, like, I kind of fell into working into, like, going into policy and stuff like that and working with campaigns and trying to get people in office that'll make a difference. I fell into it, you know, and I was like, well, I am, but I found out, like, I am passionate about this. And I think, like, I want to make, I have the,
well, you're passionate.
Drive. Yes.
That's the real operative thing there for you, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I'm passionate about it, because it's not fair. And I get angry and I get passionate. And I'm like, if I have all this passion, like, I want to use it to do something good. Because, like, the thing is, like, the sad thing is, and I don't know, maybe this is healthy, but I've kind of given up the dream of music. I haven't put it away, but I've given up on the idea of it being something that will certainly happen, if that makes sense. And I don't know, maybe it's just the season I'm in right now, because, and then there's a point, maybe I'll come back to it and be like, yeah, it is going to happen. It's going to come. But, like, where I am right now, it's not happening. Like, if I don't get better, it's not happening. I can – if I sing a note too high, I pop my collarbone out. Like, I can't tour. I can't – I struggle to sing right now. It's hard. Like, there's a lot of work I have to do. I have to stabilize stuff if I ever want to pursue that again and stuff. And, you know, so – but at the very least, like, I feel like – I want to make a difference in that world too. And like, I think maybe music can play a part of that, but I'm at a point where like, I just, everything's so up in the air. It's like, I feel like I have to give up the dreams in order to realize that one, like realize a new one. You know what I mean?
Well, you got to put something down to pick something up. They mm-hmm. say.
That's what it is. I just feel like right now I'm like in an era where I have to realize what the new dream is, because the old dream still has a version of me where I don't have Ehlers Danlos.
Right.
That version of me still, like I drew this, show it to you, let me see if I can find it. I drew this a series of photos that I still think are really impactful, but one of them is, I drew this picture of me like grieving over a version of my past self. And I didn't realize that's what it was until after, because like I see the picture and I just had to like draw it.
Right.
Because there was so much trauma that like I couldn't write, couldn't do it. I just sat and drawed for like days and days on end just to process what was going on. Just so far back. But I'm like mourning a previous version of myself. And I think I'm still in that era. And I think a part of realizing a new dream and figuring out where I'm going is like properly mourning that version of myself and letting her, because I, you know, there's, yeah, there it is.
That's cool.
And like, you know, being accepting that like there's a lot of things that I thought were going to happen that aren't.
Well.
Being like, yeah, like, I'm not going to be able to.
Well, you didn't become a gypsy while you got sick.
No. But, I mean, there's, I think if I let go of what I once held on to, I'll be able to actually, like, grasp onto something that's going to go somewhere really cool. I think that's the era I'm in right now, is letting go. I've had I'm big into tarot cards because I love allegories and I love archetypes and stuff just as like a study of philosophy. And I've been in an era of just constant tower moments. And in the philosophy, it's the Tower of Babel being struck down by a lightning rod. But that lightning rod's a mercy, and that tower coming down on it's a mercy because it came down before it was too like tall enough to crumble on top of you. That's the emphasis of it. And I'm just spending like tower moment after tower moment after tower moment. And every moment I get out and it's stressful, but I realize it's a mercy in some ways, you know? So I'm trying to finish like writing out those tower moments till I get to a point where I feel like I have enough stability under me, like physically and like out externally to really start driving it again, that train again. But I know that that train has to go somewhere that makes a difference for people like me, because like if I'm gonna survive this crap and I'm gonna do something good, like I have to make things better. They can't stay the way it is. It's bad. It's so bad.
No, yeah, facts. You said two words that caught my ear: moment and era. How do you see time now?
In chapters. I've always seen time in chapters, but it's definitely see it much more something that I have absolutely no control over. I don't know why. I used to think I had lots of control over time. Like, yeah. I could manage it so well. Now I'm like, oh, I can't get an eye. It's fleeting. It's going. It's flying away from me. At all times, I wake up and I'm like, oh, man, there goes a whole day. I wasn't conscious. So I was like so sleepy and sick. You know, it makes me value time more.
Yeah.
Way more valuable to me, for sure. Like, I wasted a lot less because I don't have – I'm in spoon debt. You know, this like have you heard the term spoons from, like, the chronically ill community before? Mm-mm. It's like you have X amount of spoons to do everything every day, and, like, a normal able-bodied person has enough to do everything. But
right.
A chronically ill person doesn't. And then the next day you can go into debt with your spoons and take them out from tomorrow, right?
Yes, I'm always
in spoon debt. I'm the spoon collectors are coming for me, okay? Yeah. Like, they are calling me. They are knocking on my door.
Yeah.
And all the time. And so when you're in that kind of debt and you're debt deficit and you're constantly trying to, like, work with limited ability to be present, like, you pick where you're present a lot differently, for sure. And a big reason why I also stepped back from working was realizing that, like, I was, as much as Matt said it, in the way he said it was just as blunt as I needed to hear. He goes,
of course.
This is a really important job. He's like, but you can't kill yourself watching other people's kids. I was like, you're right. So
very valuable to have people like that in your life.
Oh yeah, big time. I mean, and the having a support network and having those ride or dies, that is the only reason I'm still here. 100%. That's also why I'm so community oriented and like so passionate about like making community something that's not like a privilege, but like something that everybody can have access to, you know, and that's something that we don't have, like the way our societies and like even down to just the way that our cities are built don't create community. You know what I mean? Like we're so isolated from each other and we all like live in these really isolated bubbles. And it's like, that's why I'm really passionate about getting more people connected. And music is a big part of that. And I want to, but it's interesting because like right now I have to, one of the questions I want to answer for myself is how does music play into that? I don't have the answer to that yet, you know, besides telling those stories, obviously, and like amplifying my experience and telling that story, but I still haven't figured that out yet. And I'm patient. When it comes, it'll come, and I'll know when I see it. But I just got to wait.
When was the last time, or I should say, when did you first start experiencing any physical negatives whilst singing? The first time that happened?
When I was singing, and I was, it was a year ago. I was singing, and I was driving a car. And I was, you know, I was singing in the car, right?
Yeah.
And I went to hit a high note, and then I couldn't see for 5 to 6 seconds. I was blind. Like, I lost all my vision. I couldn't see because something pinched back here, and it took my vision away for about 5 minutes. And thankfully, I was driving on a straight road, and I did not crash the car, but then I don't like to drive anymore. Like ever since then, I get scared of driving a car. I try not to if I can avoid it, and I don't sing in the car anymore because I don't want to go blind while I'm driving. That was the first time. And yeah, there's times where, but it's odd because singing is also one of the tools I use for physical therapy.
Right.
To help, because I have such like so much training in those fine muscles and those motors that I can actually utilize it as, because one of the biggest issues I have with my condition is my brain doesn't know like where I am in space because my joints are so soupy. So proprioception's a big deal. So that's why sometimes I wear tape like all over my body, on my knees and my ankles too, because it adds support and proprioception. So my brain actually knows where those joints are and can execute those motions properly. And one of the things that I've found that adds proprioception to help with the instability, because I have a ton of like tiny subluxations and issues all up in my neck, is singing. Because I can tell when the note's resonating correctly. I can tell when it's coming through the body, and actually like the ability to connect to the diaphragm and like having proper that muscle control is really like difficult. I can't do it automatically, but because I've spent so many years of my life training to do it, I can switch into it really easy. I have a lot of muscle memory, so it's been really helpful, and I do try to use it. But it is also at the same, it's a tightrope now, because it's super easy for me to sing too hard and pop something out. Even when I was at Berkeley, they scoped me, and they looked, because I was having a lot of tension in my voice, and they scoped, and I thought I had nodes, but they said that when I sang, my muscles completely obscured the camera. I had like the worst muscular tension they'd ever seen in anybody ever. And it's because there's not enough structural stability to hold myself up. So with singing, it's definitely a tightrope that I'm still I have to relearn a lot of like actual practical skills with singing that. Kind of like I had to relearn a lot of things. Celine Dion's kind of experience right now with her MS and mm-hmm. like her not being able to sing in the way she like it. It's I know what that feels like. It's gotta be really, really difficult, because I'm like going through my own mini version of that. So she's Celine Dion, of course. It's totally different story. But I was watching that and I started crying. And I was like, I know what you're going through. Like, I can't. I'm struggling to sing too. Like. It's horrible. It's terrible. And like the one thing that like you innately are really, really great at doing hurts you. You have to be really gentle with it.
So I can't. Yeah, I can't imagine.
Yeah.
But you still, like you said, you found new ways to exercise.
Yeah.
Your creativity and your passion and ambition.
Yeah. And I'm trying to, and I do think there's still a world where I'm going to go back to singing. I just think right now that like there's so much like hurt and emotional woundedness around it, because that was like something I did have to put on pause, and like, you know, I feel like in a lot of ways it was taken from me by my own body.
Right.
You know? So there's a lot of emotional turmoil.
How hard is it to shake that feeling?
off. I haven't shaken it. It's still there. I've figured it out. Yeah. I'm still working on it. That's why I go to therapy every week.
But I mean, there's gotta be the parts of you that, due to the resilience and pragmatic nature of the way you think, can realize that, you know, it's really your turn to make lemonade, not be sad about the lemons.
Yeah. And I don't think, well, right now the problem is that there's so many fucking lemons that the last thing I want is another goddamn glass of lemonade.
Right.
That's the thing. Yeah. So I'm like, I'm just going to put the lemons down.
Yeah.
That's where I'm at. The lemons are down. That's why it's like I'm sad about them and I know they're upsetting, but I'm like, the last thing I want is another glass of fucking lemonade. So I'm just going to take a break and heal myself. And when I'm ready for lemonade, let's roll again.
So what is that the best way you've been able to provide yourself the freedom for growth?
Yeah, you have to be willing to let go, because if like that's the biggest thing, like something like I didn't die, but a version of myself definitely did. And the idea of how I thought things were going to go for me and my life and my priorities, all of that had to die. But I have a choice. I could stay dead. Or I could resurrect something else. But resurrecting something else is a lot more work than most people realize. It doesn't just be like, oh, new person. Like,
oh, yeah,
you have to
right.
pick it. You have to choose it. Yeah, I'm Frankenstein. I have to Frankenstein my own new version of self. It's not just like I'm not fully resurrect, you know? Piece it together.
Well, I've always known you as someone who has been like all in on plan A's. You've been a plan A champion.
I've had to give that one up. The
yeah.
plan A, but I think that has to do with like genuinely being like autistic and struggling with change. Like it's actually it's a diagnostic issue for me. Like when if my schedule changes, like I'm so flustered and anxious and stressed, it takes me 2 weeks to adjust. Like little change, like not going to work every day. I don't know what day of the week it is. And I wake up every morning in a panic because I'm like I forgot something. And
right.
it's just I'm not working every day right now. So changing like course and learning to pivot was a skill set that I had to come to terms with the fact that, like, this is actually, like, a problem for me. It's not just, like, a character thing I have to work through. Like, my brain goes into fight or flight response every time there's a change. So I had to go approach it from a different, like, having empathy for that, understanding that sometimes the plans are going to have to shift. And something that helps me is having multiple plans now. I make more than one plan. So then when one goes, then I don't feel so stressed, because a big part of it I realized was, oh, I put all my ducks in plan A.
Right.
If I did, I wouldn't be so attached to plan A if I had a couple of other ones that I knew had like a percentage chance of doing well too. So I learned how to put eggs in more baskets and stuff like that, and spread out my my thoughts and stuff and plans and stuff like that. So, you know, it's like, okay, like right now, like when it comes to music, here's what the plan is. The plan is we are just writing. That's plan. We're writing, we're creating, we're letting the juices flow. Healing, doing physical therapy, and when it's time for the plan to shift, the plan will shift. And that's kind of where I've gotten.
So maybe plan A has changed to just be adaptability.
To be adaptable. Plan A is be adaptable, is learn how to adapt and learn how to flow with it. And, like, I've had to learn that, like, the thing is that the plan, what it does is it focuses you. That's what it's for. It's to focus your efforts. And so when you're up every day and you're doing stuff, you're making sure that, like, the time you're spending is going towards something meaningful. That's why people make plans, so that our time is not wasted and we do as things as efficiently as possible. My issue is that, like, if I have to also realize that there's external factors that can come in and mess all that up, right? It doesn't matter how perfect your plan is. If the variables change, the plan is different and it doesn't work as well anymore. So that was a big part of it, too, is just becoming more adaptable and learning, like, it's okay. Like, I want to feel like I'm not wasting my time. So if I have different things that I always know are good, productive, and do good things, so like even rest, I had to learn how to make rest productive, you know, stuff like that. So then I don't feel like I'm losing the plan. And stuff
right.
like that. I don't feel so attached to it, because it is all part of the plan. The plan's just right now, but honestly, the plan's just to like stay alive.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's partly why I asked what your view of time is like now, because that – and normally I don't speak so much anecdotally about myself, but this is just one of the weird things that
you
and I haven't
had
in common yet.
We have empathy.
You know, it makes you see time very differently.
Yeah, the future's harder to see. It's foggier.
It made me way less anxious about it.
Yeah.
One of the things for me was, once you get so close to dying, and I've I've had sepsis a few times in my life. The last one was just the worst one. Once you get so close to that, it almost takes like, it almost turns the volume down on everything else. It's like, what of this is actually going to matter to me? What of this can I actually, unless you're going to take me to that point, you know what I mean?
I started caring about a lot. Like, the things I cared about got very small, for sure.
And then bigger inherently. Fewer, but larger.
Yeah. A smaller amount of things that take up all your vision. You know what I mean? Like, you just don't have the capacity for anything else. And so you have to, like, when you have to ration.
How much did it make you aware that you spend 24 hours in your head alone?
Oh, I was aware of that beforehand. That was why I went to psychiatrist and said, I think something's wrong with my brain. Like, that's why I started the brain journey long before the health journey, because I was like, my brain does not stop moving. There's like 1,000 trains going and they're all choo-chooing all at once. And then it's going, it's driving me crazy.
Yeah.
And then they're like, well, there's like I got tested for ADHD, and my psychiatrist was like, it's like really bad. I thought I ate the test too. I did really good. I thought, like, I did the test and I was like, damn, like, I don't think I don't have ADHD. Like, I did so good on that. And, he was like, and then he looked at it and he goes, woo, it's bad. And I was like, what? And I look at it and I was like, oh my God, I did not realize how bad it was. And so then I started
taking... Does this mean something's wrong or I got a superpower?
Oh, yeah. And then I started taking Adderall and then all the trains had conductors.
Yeah, right.
So much better now that they all got conductors and they all go on a little bit of schedule now. So they're less crazy. But yeah, there's always stuff. I knew that long before. And then when I got sick... That was when all I had was, like, those trains went to some really scary places.
See, and that's the reason why I asked. Because
that's why I drew.
That's what it was like for me, and partly because I was in the hospital during COVID times and I was dead alone. You know, like, so I'm curious.
This was another one I drew, which probably can emphasize the way that feels. That was, so I drew that. That's my representation of, so do you know the story of Godfather Death, the Grimm's fairy tale?
I don't.
It's based on that. Actually, even on the bed, it was a little Easter egg I wrote in there. It's called Godfather Death. It's a fairy tale from the Grimm's brother. I wrote it in there. And it's about a world famous physician who was, when he was like born, he was born in a family of like too many kids. And the father was like trying to find a ward for him and ends up giving him to death because death is neutral, long story short. And then he is able to consult death. And death, if death stands at their feet, they will live. If death stands at the head, they will die. And so he becomes a world-famous musician. Physician, being able to accurately tell if people are going to live or die very well. And then the one thing death says to him was, like, don't ever... You know, if I stand at their head, that means that the life belongs to me. They have to come with me. Then he gets to consult with the king, and the king's sick, and he's like, oh, no, death's standing at his head, which means that the king's going to die, and he's afraid of what's going to happen, so he flips the king, so then death is standing at his feet. And death is angry at him, and he comes at him, and he says, because I love you, and you're my, like, godson, I'll give you this one time, but the next time, and that's what this picture is, you get one more shot. That's what it felt like. That's what resonated from me. He's like, you have one more chance, but if you ever try to take what is mine, the life that will be, like, there's a life debt, and the debt will be paid with your life. And then the king, then he has to heal his wife, and death is standing at his wife's head, and he flips him, and death takes him instead, and he takes him to this cave of all these candles and shows him that, like, a new candle cannot be lit until one goes out. And so he chopped his candles in order to light another one because he tried to take, like, the life that was going to, you know, he used to mess with the cycle. And that's what I felt like it was. That whole representation was just like being faced with the idea of death. It's like, hey, does it matter how much you care, want, or what your emotions are about this or how you feel about it? If you're going to die, you're going to die.
Right.
And that was a lot to reckon with, and it definitely changed my perception of time, because that was the other thing. Like, you had to come to terms with the fact that, like, once it's time to go, it's time to go.
Right. And you're not going to see that coming necessarily.
No. I didn't think it was coming. None of us did. And then now 1 hour away. And, you know, a lot of the symbolism I drew had to do with, like, time, like death being just a passing
a marker of time.
Yeah, marker of time, but also I think the way I see death is more of actually a guide through time.
Hmm.
death is just there to, death is part of the natural cycle of things, and it's all how it works, but we're really afraid of it because we don't know what happens after it, you know? So, you know, when you get face to face with it, like, you kind of come to terms, like, you have two choices. You either get, like, really freaked out, and, like, I could totally see a world where I went down that, because I still have PTSD from, like, almost dying, of course. Like, every time I get pain in my kid, yeah, I get pain up here, I am bawling my eyes out and freaking out, and I want to, and I'm like, I'm gonna have sepsis again.
No, every time.
Like, it just, yeah, every time. No, like, I felt that from you, feel it. That No. Like, the trauma of it. But at the same time, like, you, it can, you can allow it to overcome you. And I was like, this is either going to overcome me, or I'm going to have to, or I'm going to be, like, really chill with it and find a way to, like, be able to sit with it and not let it overtake me. And I think I've gotten to that point where I'm, like, okay with it. It's still scary. It's still frustrating. But, like, I've made peace with it.
What would you say your biggest source of peace is?
I don't know. Because when I was younger, I might have said something like God. But now I wouldn't say that anymore. So I don't know. I would say, like, I think just the, like, my biggest source of peace is definitely comes from my support system, for sure. And the people in my life. Like, knowing that, like, you know, I've had so many, like, issues and instabilities and, like, so many things shifting from beneath me that, like, the thing that has brought me the most peace is most certainly being, like, no matter what has shifted, my family and my support network and the people who I call my family, found and blood, are always there. That's the biggest source of peace. And I do not know what I would do without it. So blessed to have that. Because I know there's so many stories out there that don't include that part.
Yeah. A lot of people struggle in their head alone and physically alone.
And I don't know what I can't. I dealt with it just a little bit in California, and it almost took me out. That was a big thing. Acknowledging I cannot be by myself, that was a big thing. Like, I had to make big changes to my life and where I was and physically in the country to make sure that, like, I was not alone again, because I can't do that.
No,
we gotta be alone together. No. Alone That's, together, yeah, always. Yeah,
right. That's where it started. That's where it'll continue to be. So let's try to get you out of here on something fun.
Yeah. This is always a depressing, like, that's something, another thing. Like, people are like, tell me your story. I'm like, oh
I know.
About to just bring the whole mood down. Yeah. About to be such a depressing moment right now. Okay.
When people ask you that, it's almost just like, there's the part of you I'm sure doesn't want to talk about it. And then there's the part of you that's like, okay, I'm not sure you really want to hear about what you just asked me.
I'm not sure you want to know the answer to that question. Sometimes I tell, they're like, you know, do you want to? I'm like, yeah, I'm fine talking about it. I just feel bad because it's like kind of a downer think about. I try to be as, like, lighthearted and throw so as many jokes in there, but then sometimes people are, like, disturbed that I have, like, they have to have a sense of humor about it, or else you can't make it.
Well, and that's that's actually something I want to ask you about before I can try to rack my brain for something fun. When was it that you started to get to the point where any of the irony or any of the things you could laugh at?
Because
I remember that point personally, and it was one of those, like, savior moments. It was like, wait a minute, the trick to this is finding what's kind of funny about this.
I think that's the only way I can cope in general, because immediately I was, like, on the phone with – I was telling Matt, I was like, can you believe I was in the ambulance telling them I'm just overstimulated. Meanwhile, I'm going into septic shock. Like, I literally was in the ambulance like, I'm fine. I just – my ribs hurt, and I'm a little overstimulated, and sometimes I throw up when I'm over – and Matt was like, yeah, no, meanwhile, you're in septic shock. We joke about it all. The second – is the week I'm in the hospital, still I have antibiotics going through my system. I'm like, haha, I almost died. Like, you have to have fun. You have to, like, make light of it, or else you don't, or you just feel like shit all the time.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think it's powerful to be able to find
humor in it. It's taking power over it, because then like, you're deciding, like, it's this really, really awful traumatic thing, and you're saying, like, but I'm gonna laugh about it because that's my choice. That's, like, the only, like, when it comes to humor and the way we feel about it, I feel like humor is sometimes one of the few mechanisms and tools where we can exert control over the way we, like, actually react to it, you know? And, like, it's so crappy. It's like, well, I have control over at least finding a moment to laugh about it. It gives us control back.
Okay, I lied. I thought I was going to get you out of here on something fun, but, but I actually have a poignant question I want to ask, because it's a question that people have asked me that I very rarely get the chance to ask anybody else, and it isn't even related to my sepsis and that stuff. It's related to my visual impairment. I get asked a lot, and I want to ask you, if you could alleviate yourself from your health challenge right now, and just go back to the way it was, would you do that, or would you bear it because this has become your like?
No, give it back. Yeah. I don't want it. Like, if I can return that, I would give it back. I've learned so many great lessons, and I'm good. I don't need to learn any more from this.
No, I don't even necessarily mean about the learning from it, but
it's the pain. Chronic pain. Nobody wants
unbelievable.
To. No, it's not.
Unbelievable.
It's not worth it. I'm like, what's the coolest thing I can do? Like, I'd bend my bones a little bit to like party trick, and I do have. The one nice benefit is that we do people with my condition like look younger than we are because of how our skin makes us look really young for our age. That's the only benefit, and it's not worth it. I would rather have bad skin than constant pain and suffering in my joints. Like, it's like I would love to stop playing the world's shittiest game of Tetris all day long. I would give that up in a heartbeat. If I had a genie in a bottle, first choice. Make my body better. That would be my first wish.
Okay.
Make my body better if I had a genie in a bottle. Second wish, I think I'd want a Death Note. And then the third, I'd set the genie free.
I like that.
Yeah.
So that's normally how my last questions would end. What would you do if you had a genie? What would you do? So, okay, so you already beat me to the punch of that one. And I got my poignant one out.
Yep.
Okay, you make your wishes. Your body is back to normal. And
I get a Death Note.
Yep.
And then I set the genie free.
Okay, then what do you do on day one?
With a Death Note?
With whatever you want to do. You're good.
When day one?
You're good.
Day one. Do
you try to sing all day long? Do you try to...
Something really ridiculous with my body physically. Like, I'm like, all right, let's see how far
bungee
I can
jumping?
Push this bit. Like, let's see. I might break a couple bones in the process. I'm going to see how far I can push it. Go do the rock climbing. Go do all the things that, like, I usually get really... I want to do, but I can't, you know, because I'm so sick and tired all the time. Honestly, I'd probably just go get a job again and be like, I can work and have a paycheck and not have to worry about it. Yay, I'd go get a job. Day one, I'd go back to working so I can feel independent again.
Well, that's not...
I can relate to
that though. But once you lose any independence, regaining it
is a big deal.
Oh, and it feels awesome.
It feels so, so good.
It's liberating in a way that able-bodied people don't understand. And that's not like a holier than thou thing or whatever. That's just one of those things. Like if you don't experience, it's impossible to relate to.
Yeah. And then day one, I also go billionaire by billionaire down the death note right there. Billionaire by billionaire, all the billionaires go. That's my day one with my genie wishes.
Well, when science comes for us, I'll be able to drive you to go do all that stuff and you'll be ready to go.
Let's do it. It's
well,
always
Sky,
a
thank
coming
you so
back.
Much.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, thank you for coming. Next time you're coming back with Matt.
Yes.
When
we're
you watch this.
We're bringing Matt. Matt, you're coming with us.
Thank you.